There's a way to test how many of these aerosols you produce. You breathe into a little machine. If I were to give that test to all of you in this room right now, what we would discover is that almost all of you emit a relatively small number of aerosols. What that means is that if all of you right now had COVID, you wouldn't be at risk for infecting that many people, because you're just not producing enough aerosols, right? But there's, with absolute statistical certainty, I can say that in this room, there are gonna be maybe half a dozen people who produce 50 times or 100 times more aerosols than everybody else. If that person has COVID, watch out, right? It's, in other words, the phenomenon of transmission is asymmetrical. Only a handful of us matter. And I tell the story in a book of a very famous super-spreading event where one guy ends up infecting 300,000 people.
One guy.
He was one of those people who was, and the next time around, and the reason I think this is such an important lesson is, when we were trying to stop COVID, we basically got it all wrong because we did a series of steps that asked all of us to stay home, all of us to socially distance, all of us to wear masks. But the problem was never about all of us. The problem was all about a few of us. And the next time around, if we know this, it's a very different and in some ways more problematic conversation, because there's something very socially and politically convenient about saying it's all of us.
It's all what?
It's all of us.
It's all of us, yes.
If we say next time it's actually only, you know, it's only a half dozen of you, what happens to those half dozen, right? Are we mature enough politically to handle that without stigmatizing those people, without, I'm not sure actually that we are. I think we're gonna just say, oh, the first thing that's gonna happen is if we can identify them, we're gonna say, you can't leave your house, or are we gonna lock them up? I mean, who knows what we'll do? I can't, so it's a, like I said, it's a different conversation, and we have to be starting to have that conversation now.
But there were so many inconvenient truths, if I can coin a phrase, in your book that made me very uncomfortable in the light of what you're describing there.
Yeah.
And you didn't offer any solutions.
No, I don't, I'm not, I mean, I did kind of, I think by illuminating the nature of the problem and by asking the right questions, you're halfway to a solution, right? I think this is a parenthetic, something I've thought a lot about, and I've had conversations with friends of mine. A friend of mine who's a very gifted screenwriter, he says the same thing, which I think is absolutely brilliant. When he writes his first draft of a screenplay and he hands it around, he says, I don't need to know how to fix the problem with my screenplay. I need to know what the problem is, right? That half the time identifying the problem is the hardest part of the process of making something better. Once you know what the problem is, most of the time the solution is straightforward, right? So I don't need to spell out solutions. I think I need to help us identify what the problem is.
So that's your driver to look at what propels a negative social change?
I think that's a very useful role.
So in exploring the role of super spreaders, you're also exploring the role of people best positioned to ignite a behavior or an idea.
Yeah.
Anybody in mind?
Yeah, I'm not going there. Not 2 weeks to go.
But I want to go back to that point about celebrity. Mm-hmm. And just, where are we in terms of how we view celebrity as a nation, as a tribe? When I say tribe, I mean Americans.
Yeah.
Or as regionalists, or as Democrats, or as Republicans, however you want to position us.
Yeah. Are we, well, my question
maybe I have the wrong question. Tell me what question I should ask.
No. On the celebrity front, I'm not convinced. It seems to me that celebrity, like if we go back 75 years, go back to the 50s,
mm-hmm.
Isn't a celebrity in the 50s a lot bigger deal than a celebrity today? Like, if Bob Hope walked in this room in 1955, we'd all melt down. I mean,
right, but
or
nobody...
Marilyn Monroe is, in her day, is a way bigger deal than any comparable actress today.
But no one would, I mean, Ronald Reagan ran for president, but he wasn't the celebrity of Bob Hope.
Yeah.
Do you see what I'm saying? That Bob Hope's celebrity was central to his place and space. It was, Bob Hope had a place in a space and in the zeitgeist of Americans, like the idea of him crossing over. And Ronald Reagan went into politics long before he, whether it was, you know, in the 50s with, you know, the Red Scare, or as governor of California before he went on to run for president several times and then finally win. But there's
really
something, I'm saying, you have celebrities entering politics now.
Even really
like JFK Jr., who had never been in, I mean, if he, what?
You're just itching for me to talk about Trump.
I am not itching. No, I'm talking about celebrity because it fascinates me. And
yeah.
Am I right about that? I mean, like, look at it from my, from what I just gave you.
Well.
No?
I mean, I'm a Canadian. I don't really have much to say about
there you
politics.
Go. You know, ironically, I'm going to be in Canada, ironically, the day after the election.
Well, that's a good place to be.
For work. I'll be interviewing a fellow author of yours, a fellow Canadian.
Yeah.
Care to guess? Keep guessing. We'll talk about it later. How much time do we have? Is it time to wrap it up? I asked a friend of mine who's read every single one of your books and was like, I cannot believe you get to sit across from him. And he sent seven questions, but I promised that I would ask you at least one.
Okay.
And it stems from, like, he has two people who were his heroes, Martin Luther King and Albert Einstein.
Okay.
He says, Martin Luther King Jr. often emphasized the inescapable network of mutuality that binds humanity. How do you see this idea of interconnectedness reflected in the way you've written about the underdogs and misfits in society, like you did in David and Goliath? Mm-hmm. And you've often considered yourself as an underdog, even though you're like the superstar now. I'm curious both how you view yourself and answering, you know, his point in the underdog and misfit.
Well, I mean, he's right in the sense that a lot of the writing that I've done about people, not just about success, but a theme that runs throughout all my books is that I don't think people can be understood outside of their context, their social context, their regional context, and that the mistake I think we make is, particularly Americans, is to do that too much, is to think you can look at someone in isolation and have a good sense of who they are. There's a famous psychological experiment, I think, that was done by a guy named Richard, I think it's one of Richard Nisbet's experiments, where they have an aquarium with fish in it, and some really, very big fish and little fish and stones and rocks and things. You show the aquarium to a group of American school kids and you have them look at it for like a minute, and then you have them write down what they saw, right? And what you find when you do that is that most of the kids will talk about the big fish. There's this big fish there, he was purple and yellow and, you know, he was eating this. Take the exact same aquarium and you show it to a group of Japanese kids and they'll describe everything but the big fish.
Like?
They'll talk about the context, the rocks and the trees and the little fish and the shape of the this. And they're seeing, both of them are looking at the same thing, but they're seeing it in very different ways. And I think that both of these ways of making sense of the world have their strengths. But I feel like one of the things I've tried to do is to get us to look at the aquarium a little bit more like the Japanese kids. In other words, to never to look at somebody outside of the context of where they're from or who they hang out with or what kind of network they're a part of. And I think that's a necessary corrective, because I think that one of the things that happens, this was the thing that drove my book Outliers, for example, was just the observation that as people get successful, their stories change about why they're successful, and they start to edit out everyone around them. And I it's funny because I remember this.
I literally had this conversation right before we went out on stage with someone.
Oh, really?
Oh, my gosh. You're so relevant. You're so relevant, Malcolm.
The moment when I thought about the most was I was talking to this guy who was a world-class chess player, and I was asking him about how he came to play chess. Mm-hmm. And he said he grew up in suburban New York. And he said, oh, I used to play all the time in Washington Square Park and all the chess clubs around downtown, around Greenwich Village. And I was like, yeah, but you grew up in, I forget what it was, White Plains, somewhere way out there. How'd you get there when you were like 12? He goes, oh, my mom used to drive me. And I was like, oh, so it's about your mom. Your mom, who could have been doing any number of things, probably had a job, would drive in rush hour, whatever, after school every day, take you whatever it was, an hour and a half into the city, wait for you when you're like 11 so you could play all that, and then take you back. So you can't tell a story about your chess prowess without talking about your mom, right? It doesn't happen without, and he, all the moms, yes.
To the moms in the corner and the moms in the room, hey, 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 oh, I'm sorry.
But,
and the dads.
And the dads.
Because there are dads who do that too.
But I thought that was like, and I think he understood that, but there was some part of me that wondered that if he ever became the greatest chess player in the world, his mom would fall out of his success story.
Wow.
And that, so the whole book, Outliers, was an attempt to put those other, to repopulate our stories about success with...
the people whose shoulders we're standing on.
Yeah, and the context and the rock in the corner and what that... And then even in this book as well, you know, there's a lot of discussion in this book about what it means to come from a particular community and how the stories that communities tell each other.
Oh, my gosh. There's so much good stuff in here. Can I just say, we could be talking for another 2 hours, but there are questions that I know many of you have out there. So let's get to it. Who has a question? Okay, who has the mic? Where are we going with this? I did not listen to you at all when you told me what direction to follow. So the mics are coming to you. Race to these hands. Race to them. Do you not see these people right up front? Come on. Guys, come on. They're all just grab somebody. There we go. Stand up.
I'm a little short, so you might think I'm still sitting. Hi, my name is Rochelle. It is an honor for me to be here with you, Mr. Gladwell. I've read, I think, all of your books, and I've enjoyed them so much. My job is I'm actually a martial arts instructor, and I teach kids, and I try to sprinkle in some of the things that I've learned from your books to these kids to try to help them get some of the life skills and see things the way that you see them. So now that you are a father, and I'm in a position to, I think, influence kids in like a personal development, social understanding kind of way, what are some of the things that you like would love to just like point out and say, yes, teach them this? I think the, you know, seeing the rocks is one that you just answered.
Yeah.
But are there some lessons for kids that you're like, oh, I wish I could, you know, I wish this was taught in schools?
I was much more willing to give advice on parenthood before I was a parent.
Now, I was going to ask about that, yeah.
I realize what a... Who knows, you know? Like, one day they're one thing, and one day they're the other thing. No, a serious answer to the question is, one of the lovely things about parenthood is that there's no such thing as an original observation. Every single thing you think about your kids has been thought about by parents a billion times in human history. I find that very, very refreshing. So what I'm about to say, every parent in the room has also thought, but you know, parenthood, as far as I understand it, is just about the steady narrowing of your expectations for your children. And at this point, I just want them to be nice people and to work hard. Those are those two. And the second one is the one I worry the most about, because I think so much of what is meaningful and joyful in life comes from the application of effort. And so if I can teach them that, I would have succeeded.
Question over here.
And if I could people just line up in at the center of the room if you have a question? I hate to do that to people, but so we can get through this.
Yeah.
Hi.
Over here.
What a fascinating conversation. I'm really intrigued by the discussion of history and the Holocaust. And what comes to my mind is this, like, defiant unwillingness of us Americans to learn from or even remember history, even recent history. I've had conversations, political conversations, with people that support, you know, the other guy, and they're like, nothing bad happened. Things are great. There were no wars. How can we fix this? Do you have any ideas?
Yeah. Well, you know, the lesson of the chapter on the Holocaust, one of them, is that I think sometimes we default to a position that says, if something happens, it means it will be remembered and talked about. And we forget that we remember things, we remember only those things that we make a concerted effort to remember, right? And that in the absence of that concerted effort, not only do things get forgotten, but things get distorted. And I think what has happened in this country, I would say, is that we've gotten a little lazy about that. And we've forgotten that you need to retell the stories, the important stories in your history, to every generation. Or, you know, like, the idea, this is just a random example, but like, I don't know if you followed this thing about how this historian, who's essentially a Holocaust denier, was on the Tucker Carlson show, like, whatever it was, and was presented as a guy with all kinds of fresh ideas. Like, we're getting sloppy when Holocaust deniers are getting easily into the public discourse.
But is that right? Sloppy, or is that intentional? Because, I mean, that a lot of the denial of what has happened in history has been intentional. I mean, and I'm going back, let's go back 150 years of like retelling a narrative of how something happened. I think there's intention. It's not like happenstance. I know Malcolm Gladwell, but my little bit on that subject is everything that I've read. People intentionally changed the way people viewed something and how it went down. We're talking about the Civil War. We're talking about the whole framework of what happened during Reconstruction. Mm. And there's stories I'm telling today. People didn't know about the Mercury 13 and women who like were part of the space age, or the hidden figures. Like, those are stories, recent memory. Somebody didn't just forget about it. They intentionally sideline these people.
No, I agree with you. And it is because of those intentional acts that we need to be more rigorous in confronting, and not confronting is the wrong word, but in making sure that the machinery of memory remains intact, right?
Are we doing that? Do you feel like we're doing that?
My point is
it's up to you guys. Yeah. It's up to your collective memory, I think. Mm-hmm. That's just one black woman's opinion. I'm just saying. He's Jamaican, Canadian. Canadian, Jamaican.
Mixture of many.
Many things, many things. Yeah. Me too. I have a book. I wrote about it. I'll send it to you.
Hi, my name is Laura. I've also read most of your books, I think. And you made the comment about apologizing for something that you got wrong. I think it's super important to talk about, because you've talked about context and being able to look at the context of things. And I think people underestimate what they knew at the time and doing the best with the information that they had at that time. And I think that we need to find better ways to normalize how people viewed and acted on something at a certain point in time. And in order to grow, instead of demonizing people, really work on better ways to get them to say, yeah, I made a mistake, and get, have it be okay without like completely killing people. Now granted, there are some things that, yeah, it doesn't work in that manner, but to be able to really admit when you're wrong, I learned something new, because especially like the stuff with the pandemic was really eye-opening. You know, you talked about the story with the Denver and the air pollution and everything else. And information is power, and being able to say, all right, we know better, so we do better. Mm-hmm. And finding better, like, do you have better ways or ways that we all might do better to say, all right, we now know better, so we're doing better? And normalize being able to say, oh yeah, I got that wrong. Because if we have another pandemic, one of the biggest problems was they didn't want to correct the information that they got wrong. And it just got perpetually worse.
Yeah. No, I think I've always been a little bit baffled by people's reluctance to say, to admit when they were wrong. Because when I hear somebody say that, it signals to me that this is someone whose mind is open and who thinks about learning as a kind of ongoing process. My dad was someone who I kind of modeled this baby for me. He was someone who, he actually seemed to delight in changing his mind when he learned something new. And it was always expressed to me as part of what is exciting about being alive in the world is learning something new that allows you to update your... So I've never had any kind of sense of shame with saying I was wrong. I do think that I guess I should maybe do a better job of trying to teach other people about how easy... I don't find it hard, and it shouldn't be hard, and I find people are willing to accept that kind of admission quite readily. And maybe we just overestimate how difficult it's going to be. I don't really understand why politicians have trouble with this, and why we privilege consistency in our leaders. I mean, I can understand consistency on matters of values, but not on ideas. Like, if you're learning, you change your mind every now and again.
Stuff changes all the time, right?
Question over here.
So we have time for one more question.
Hi, Malcolm. Nice to meet you. I've read all of your books. One thing I know you talk about in this book is about small group variation and about overstories. And I want to know if you've ever thought of that in the context of gun violence. Mm-hmm. In the United States, and if there's any views or thoughts you have on that.
Yeah, so one of the things I talk about in this book is this idea called small area variation, which is an idea that comes from healthcare, from the observation that the way medicine is practiced in, excuse me, the way medicine is practiced varies tremendously from one community to the next. You can have, in the classic work on this, some guy goes to the state of Vermont and points out that Stowe and Waterbury, which are side by side, in one place all the kids have their tonsils out and the other place none of them do. And you would never know this just by looking. They looked like the same population, same state, same everything. And the point was that communities have their own kinds of stories about what it means to practice medicine, or what it means to be a good citizen, or what it means to behave in a certain way. And those stories have real power, and we need to pay more attention to them. Your question was about gun violence. As it turns out, I think there's a guy named, I'm gonna get his name wrong. It's a Greek name, Christa something. Christa Papa. I'm terribly embarrassed. But he's a sociologist at Northwestern, who has done exactly this work in looking at patterns of homicide, in which he observes that if you look at, he does social maps of people who are victims of gun violence, and finds that if someone in your social circle is involved with an incident of gun violence, your chances of being involved in a gun violence incident go up sevenfold. And he then takes that observation and he points out, he did all this work on the west side of Chicago. The west side of Chicago is an area of 50,000 people, one of the most dangerous areas in the country. And using these kinds of maps, he shows that actually it's not a dangerous neighborhood. It's much more specific than that, that there are little social pockets that are incredibly dangerous and other areas that have no real problem whatsoever. And that, in fact, he said at any given time in that neighborhood of 50,000 people, there are only about 400 people who are actively at risk for gun violence. It's super specific, right? And that little world of people caught up in this, they're having a little mini epidemic that's going on very specific corners and blocks and at very specific places. And that's a really transformative insight about the nature of social problems. And it's really a kind of version of what I was saying earlier about how COVID is about six people in this room. If gun violence is about 400 people in a neighborhood of 50,000, then the appropriate response to it suddenly looks really different, right? It's not about blanketing the whole area with police officers. It's about understanding those precise social and community dynamics that put that very small number of people at risk for spreading this contagion. So I think I'm optimistic that we are slowly coming to understand, when we look at social problems, their shape. And that when we understand their shape, I think we're gonna do a lot better job of defeating them.
So in the end, what I hear is you're an eternal optimist.
I am.
You are.
You sort of have, I think you kind of have to be in the world, because otherwise, you know, why would you plan for the future? Why would you have kids? Why would you get up in the morning? Why would you do anything if you didn't think that
you waited a long time?
I did wait a long time to have children, but
so glad you did it.
Yeah, no, it is now. Now optimism is no longer a choice; it's a necessity.
Ah,
so.
Ladies and gentlemen, Malcolm Gladwell. Thank you.
That concludes this evening's program. Thank you all so much for coming. I know this is a conversation that we will all be thinking about for a long time to come. Just before we adjourn, can we have one more round of applause for our two brilliant speakers?
Was that okay? Oh, Lord.